forever be a legend here at Tottenham. It's a massive club. Everything I do is for the long term.
And still Ricky Villa. What a fantastic run. He scored.
That's going to have a crack. He is, you know. Oh, I say.
Here's Lucas Moura.
Oh, they've done it. The wait for silverware is over.
A very warm welcome to the first Tottenham Way podcast of the PLE, or the post Levy era, as it, from this moment onwards, will always be referred to. He has gone. The one constant in the past 24 years, other than inevitable disappointment, is Daniel Levy. He's packed his bags. Technically, he stepped down. Did he step down? Was he pushed down the stairs? What does it all mean? How excited are you? How excited should you be? What are the consequences of the momentous last 24 hours at N17 following the bloodless coup? I'm Marcus Buckland. So glad that you are listening. If you are listening on our podcast, do try us out on YouTube. We've had the makeup, we've had the lighting, and thank you very much, Steve, for all your correspondence so far. We're looking to grow a little bit of a community, and you can get in touch with us, watch us on YouTube at the Tottenham Way Pod, and that's also our address for Insta and X. I'm Marcus Buckland. Alongside me is Tom Allnutt of The Times, and author extraordinaire Tom Barkley, whose new book, Miracle in Bilbao, was published this week. And we will touch on that just a little later in the programme. But first things first, Tom B, you've had 24 hours to assimilate exactly what's been going on. What is your reaction to Daniel Levy's departure?
Hi, Marcus, and thank you very much for that early plug. As you mentioned, it's going to probably need a bit of a editing after this. Sadly, the publisher's, it's already gone, so I can't add in this final part of the story with Levy going. But I was in the office yesterday, and I was just about to leave. It'd been a pretty quiet day, to be honest. I was just about to leave, come home, and then bang, around 6 o'clock. You know, one of those moments where it doesn't really happen as much in modern football news that sort of breaks and it isn't broken by someone else before. I don't believe other journalists were onto this beforehand. Probably slightly damning indictment of myself and Tom and the others not getting this first. But it was just a shock situation. And as the sort of evening developed and I started making calls and finding out more and more about it, it did transcend that he was forced out. He was forced out. It wasn't his idea. I know there were suggestions that he resigned or stepped down. I'm told that's definitely not the case. This was instigated by the Lewis family, the sort of younger parts of the Lewis family, although I say that sort of half laughing because the younger parts of the Lewis family are in their 60s, Vivian and Charlie, but as opposed to Joe Lewis, who obviously used to be the owner, but back in 2022 in October, he obviously stepped away and he's no longer part of the on the sort of beneficiary side of the Lewis Trust that effectively own Tottenham. And they have pinned it effectively on results not being good enough. Obviously, they won, as we well know, in Bilbao, as I've written about quite a lot of late. But results generally, finishing 17th in league, all the sort of complaints that you've had, Marcus, understandably, and a lot of Tottenham fans have had in the last year and going a long time before that, they seem to have a similar mindset. At least that is what I'm led to believe from speaking to sources close to the Lewis family. And that is why Levy is gone. They, a source close to them has described it to me in a quote which has been shared with other media outlets. They've sort of dubbed it a new era for Tottenham. So we've got this ownership in the Lewis family who obviously run the Tavistock Group, who are the main shareholders of Enoch, who are the main shareholders of Tottenham. Slightly complicated explanation there. Who are the longest serving owners of Tottenham in the Premier League, 25 years, I believe. There's no one else that's been owning a club as long. And yet, this feels like, or at least they seem to want to sort of present it as, a new era for the club, which I imagine a lot of Spurs fans are slightly sort of befuddled by. This is something they've been asking for such a long time, to have Levy go. They've obviously also called for Enoch to go, but particularly Levy being the face of it. And now he has gone. I think a lot of them are sort of, like yourself, Marcus, probably scratching their heads, trying to work out what it all means and where where they go from here, really.
Well, I mean, first of all, the kids have taken over. Viv, she likes to be known around the ground. Vivienne, Charles and Nick, as you rightly say, two of them in their 60s. Hey, we're all kids, whatever age we are. You know, I mean, first of all, I just want to say from my point of view, and Tommy, I can't wait to hear what you have to say. The one thing about Daniel Levy throughout this period is, as a Spurs fan, he's kind of made me feel safe in the fact that we are being wisely guided along the choppy waters of the Premier League. And when you look at the trouble that some clubs have got into, you think, OK, well, we haven't done that. We've actually grown from a club that was worth £80 million when he took over in 2001 to the figure that I've written down somewhere, some extraordinary figure of £2.6 billion at the moment. He's done a lot of extraordinary things. He's made Spurs such a wealthy club. And I do think we should respect that. And every time we go to the ground over the next 20, 30, 40 years, however long we've got left to watch this wretched team, we will acknowledge the fact that it's a state-of-the-art £1 billion ground. And I'd also want to say that I feel maybe sometimes, Tom A, he was negotiating, and that, of course, was one of his big foibles as far as Spurs fans are concerned. He made such a grind of every transfer, as Alex Ferguson said. You know, dealing with Daniel Levy was more painful than having hip replacement. And perhaps that's one key reason why he had to go, because so many of his contemporaries who he wants to do business with are fed up of doing business with him. But equally, I sometimes felt as though maybe he was negotiating with one arm behind his back, because Joe Lewis, who's been totally invisible for 24 years, seemed to have no interest in the club whatsoever. And as a result of that, I'm a little bit cynical as to what his children and grandchildren are going to do. But I'm still very excited, because for Tottenham, it's to do is to dare. And Daniel Levy did not dare enough. And now the new look group want more wins more often. And so say all of us. So based on that, Tom A, should we be as triumphant as I feel as a Tottenham fan to see the back of Daniel Levy, irrespective of what he did from a business point of view?
I mean, I think Spurs fans can feel excited about the new era. I think it's fair to call it a new era. You know, it's been 25 years of the same man at the top of the club. And whatever you say about the, you know, the complicated arrangement of who is in charge at Tottenham, Daniel Levy doesn't own Spurs. He isn't Spurs. He's not their greatest top scorer. But there's no doubt this is Daniel Levy's football club in all ways. You know, the stadium, of course, the training ground, of course. But not just that, I think the identity of the team, you know, I think of the way that people think about Spurs is the way that Daniel Levy has framed Tottenham over the last 10 years, you know, as a team who are always trying to punch above their weight, who will spend a certain amount in the market, but not too much, who will sign a certain type of player, you know, a young player perhaps who has potential, but who isn't proven. Even in terms of the managers that they've hired, generally managers who look to improve and to build rather than to finish and to win. I think everything that you think of as a modern Tottenham is what Levy has created, you know, for better and for worse. You know, that's not a criticism, it's not praise. It just is what it is. Tottenham in this current form is Daniel Levy's Tottenham. So without Levy, we have a big question mark. You know, we have a huge question mark about what comes next, you know, in terms of the leadership, in terms of the ownership, of course, but also just in terms of the strategy and the vision, you know. And in that sense, I don't know if excitement is the right word. I think it will depend entirely on each fan, on every supporter, and their strength of feeling for or against Levy. I suspect for most fans, even those like you, Marcus, maybe there is also a slight sense of trepidation and nervousness, you know, about what comes next. You're shaking your head, but I think for a lot of fans, there will also be a sense of, you know, be careful what you wish for. The next owner may not, you know, pump in all the money that we expect, may not have, you know, the same kind of belief in stability. But equally, I think change is always exciting, you know, and I compare this to other examples in the sort of, you know, Premier League era, like when Sir Alex Ferguson left Manchester United, when Arsene Wenger left Arsenal, when Jurgen Klopp left Liverpool, you know, and those are three managers. And I understand that, you know, Levy has not had the same amount of success as any of those. But in terms of the narrative of Spurs, I think Levy is just as big a figure, you know, in Tottenham kind of history, if you like, in modern history. And I think the sense of him going creates that same sense of a vacuum, you know, of a void that needs to be filled. So it's that slightly strange feeling, isn't it? It's almost like, you know, when the Queen died, or like, you know, everyone sort of can't believe the news at first. And I think we're still kind of in that slight sort of state of shock, you know, particularly as journalists, maybe. You know, I'm sure Tom has been the same, that we've been kind of head down in all the details and phone calls for the last kind of 24 hours. And it will probably take a period of days or weeks where before you really start to kind of, you know, zoom out and understand the situation. But I think for Spurs fans, yeah, I can understand excitement. It's a new era. And I think the idea of a new approach, even just people saying it, you know, obviously actions are more important than words, but even just people saying the fact that wins are more important, sporting success is more important, I think that can give people optimism for what comes next.
Well, and I think 24 years is more than enough time for one person to be in charge of a club. There's an element of, you know, staleness, I think, that creeps in. It's a quarter of a century. And Tom, be in that time, you know, like I mentioned, the fact that the club has grown enormously as a business, and the new home is fantastic, the training ground, etc. There is a great community in the area. A lot of good things have been done. Bottom line, though, in those 24 years, he's got through 16 managers. They've made it to 16 semi-finals, 7 finals, only 2 pieces of silverware. And he's contentious. And there is, or there has been, a pretty horrible atmosphere inside the ground. I mean, it does beg the question, if things continue to go wrong now, who do we start chanting to be kicked out of the club next? Because all those Levy out banners have got to go, and he's been a perfect pantomime villain to some degree. But, you know, he's made too many mistakes. And from a footballing point of view, I'm sorry, but 2 bits of silverware. And when he was asked a year or two ago about his 5 greatest accomplishments, if you recall, he didn't mention that League Cup success of 2008 either. His priorities were elsewhere. He was not aligned to the supporters. He did not communicate with the supporters. That, to me, is his biggest failing, a lack of communication and an inability to find the right people around him to communicate and explain to people like me why he was doing what he was doing. It just went on and on. And, you know, he could be ruthless, and I'm afraid now he's found out what it's like to be on the other foot. And I'm sorry, for me, it's absolutely the right thing.
Yeah, it's ironic, isn't it, how many sort of ruthless oustings of managers he's exercised over the years. And this is what happened to him, really. You make a lot of points there. First of all, just on the communication side of things, I am cautiously optimistic that going forward, we may hear a bit more from the club at the top. I would imagine that would be Vinay Venkatesham, the CEO, who sometimes spoke, I think, when he was at Arsenal in this way. He's quite a sort of a confident performer in that sort of space. I'm not sure you could say the same thing about Daniel Levy. Perhaps that was why at times he didn't want to. I'm not sure you'll see Charlie, Nick Boucher, if I pronounced that right, doing the same thing. Or
she's
Peter Charrington.
She's definitely not Viv to us, can I just say? She's definitely
Viv. Yeah, I was going to say. I know.
When Marcus said Viv at the start of the podcast, I sort of wondered if he had some in there that we were going to be able to use.
I understand that around the ground, she is known as Viv. That's all I'm saying.
There we go. Okay. Well, Vivian? I don't imagine that we can suddenly expect them to start speaking as owners like we've seen, like Sir Jim Ratcliffe, perhaps, for example, when he took over at Man United. I mean, it's weird, isn't it, talking about takeover, because it's not. It's the same people to a certain extent that have been there the whole time. But I do believe that they will probably be a bit more visible when they haven't been in the past. You probably might see them at games more often. And like I say, I think maybe Vinay hopefully might speak a bit more. And I do think that was a sort of fair criticism of Levy. Although there's part of me coming from at this from a sort of objective perspective, I do feel like owners in football eventually becomes a bit of a fool's errand, a hiding to nothing, no matter what you do, unless you just have relentless success. Eventually, if you're there long enough, people start to grow tired of you. They want to move you on, or they just demand more money being put in. I'm not saying that's, you know, the reason why fans have turned against Daniel Levy and Spurs. I'm just saying that as a sort of wider point. And when looking at his achievements, going over them, really, you know, in the last 24 hours. It is amazing how much the club grew from being worth about 70 million when Enoch first bought, what was it, 27% of Sir Alan Sugar, as he was at the time back in 2000, to take their ownership, I think, up to 29.9%. And the club was valued, like I say, around 70 million. And now is worth, you said 2.6 billion. I think it's more like 4 billion now. I mean, it's amazing how much it's worth now. But personally, I think it was the right time to go, because even in my relatively short time covering Spurs of the last sort of 3.5 years or so, it feels like every time anything goes wrong, a bad result, a transfer that doesn't come off, Eberechiezi, for example, it gets the anger just grows very quickly, and it gets directed in the direction of one person particularly. I mean, it isn't just Levy. Fans have been calling for Enoch to leave as well. As I well remember, Tom, I think you were there against Man United in February, the 1-0 game, many times beating Man United last season, but that February game with the March. I mean, it was breathtaking, really, watching thousands of fans take to the streets ahead of the match to protest against the ownership. But it was, you know, Levy was the lightning rod. And I only feel like that was just going to continue, you know, going on and on and on whenever anything went wrong. So it feels like if they want to sort of go in a new direction, that in itself is reason to sort of justify this decision.
And also, we talk about these figures. Okay, is it 2.6 billion? Is it 4 billion? It's really impressive. Who cares? As a fan, I'm sorry. If you're not spending the money in the transfer market, I don't care how much money you are making and how well Beyonce is doing and the go-karting is doing. It doesn't mean anything to the average Joe who is going to Tottenham every couple of weeks and wants to see the best players on the pitch. Our game is about glory, as so many people said. Levy was all about greed. That's possibly a bit harsh. He was all about doing the best he could for the club as far as he saw it. But Tom, that's not where the priority lies. Yes, you're a great businessman. This is still football. It's a huge business, but it's about winning, which is why they've struck a good chord, the Lewises, with this new catchphrase of winning more often, et cetera, and I'm afraid some of the other things that Levy did as well, we'll talk. You know, the legacy, I'm sure, is going to be about, oh, I'm getting so excited, my things are falling out of my ears now, but they're steaming. You know, sacking Jose Mourinho 6 days before a cup final. Ridiculous. The furlough scheme during COVID. Outrageous. I think he was a big fan of Tottenham joining the European Super League. No, thank you very much. Even this season now, if you want to have your Tottenham ticket on the share platform, you've got to make sure the person you're giving the ticket to is, I think, a One Hotspur fan. It's more money. It's. I'm sorry, I don't care if it's 50 billion that it's worth. If it leads to two bits of silverware in 24 years, it's not for me. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good list of lots of things where Daniel Levy got it wrong, and I'm sure it's a very familiar list for a lot of Tottenham fans. And I don't think it's really even necessary for me to put the argument, you know, for him. I think everyone knows, you know, his achievements off the pitch and where he took Spurs. You know, it's been very well documented. I think where I would disagree, I don't think Levy's problem was greed. I don't think he was trying to, you know, make money from the club, and he had no interest in the club success. That's when you talk to people around Levy, you don't often hear people say that he didn't have Tottenham at heart. You know, they often say that if anything, he was obsessive about Spurs to the extent where he almost didn't have the perspective that he needed, I think. And he didn't delegate well enough. Well, I mean, when people talk about communications and when they talk about visibility, I sort of accept that to a point. But there is part of me that sort of wonders, as journalists and as kind of, you know, in the kind of media landscape, whether we're slightly looking through our own camera lens there, where we're sort of thinking, yeah, we would love to have more interviews. And we'd love to see, you know, them talking on, you know, like they did with that YouTube thing with Vinay a couple of months ago, which seems quite kind of outdated, that interview now, doesn't it? When they were kind of sitting on together, you know, pledging to work together. But I actually don't think, I mean, communications visibility, sure, it's a nice thing. But if you are a well-run football club making smart decisions year in, year out, no one is worrying about whether you're visible or whether you're making good communications with the supporters. The supporters
aren't worried. It wasn't a well-run business making good decisions year in, year out, I'm afraid.
Tom, can I just interject on that one point about I was already thinking the same thing. Are we being a bit navel-gazy? And, you know, as journalists, we just want to hear from him. But I will caveat that point with, it was the managers in recent years who've been calling for more communication from the top of the club. Ange eventually got there. Conte very much made that point. I mean, it's not just journalists who are calling for it. And also, let's remember, journalists are just the conduits for the fans. So I don't know. I see what you're saying, and maybe there is a part to it, but I actually think the communication point, there is more to it than just that.
But Tom, the managers are only calling for the club hierarchy to be more visible when they're under pressure. Like, equally, when they're doing well and the results are going well and the victories are coming in, they're more than happy to be the face of the football club. But when they're under pressure and every week people like us are saying, you know, why are the team not doing well? Why do they not spend right in the transfer market? Yeah, I can imagine then they want the chief executive and they want the chairman to come out and do an interview, of course. So it's not to say that they're wrong to think that. I'm not saying that they're wrong. I just think that everyone has a slight agenda there. And to get back to the point, I actually think the problem with Daniel Levy is not so much about communication and visibility. The problem with him was, one, brilliant with the numbers, never very good on people. You talk to people around the club, they say the number of times that Daniel Levy failed to spot really good talent that Tottenham had in their ranks. You know, administratively around him, he never had the right football brains, you know, and whether that was because he was incapable of that, or whether he was unwilling to delegate the kind of power base at Spurs, I don't know. But he never had, if you look at all the clubs now, the best clubs, Man City, Brighton, whoever you want to say, the most best well-run clubs, the power is not centered in one person. You know, it's no longer a kind of chairman model. And you talk to people now who are, you know, overseeing this change, they're calling it a more of a modern structure, where Vinay is going to be the chief executive in a much more of a modern dynamic of a football club, where the power is much more spread out and, you know, where things are delegated into different departments. Daniel Levy ultimately had too much power. He wasn't able to appoint people around him who were smart football brains with really good ideas, who would say no to him on the right things. And you look at over the years, who have Spurs had in their ranks who they failed to promote? John McDermott, academy chief under Pochettino, now basically runs England behind the scenes. Brilliant, brilliant football brain. Michael Edwards, they had him as an analyst, now basically has transformed Liverpool into the kind of modern, dominant club that they are. Damien Comoli, one of the most respected administrators, sporting directors in Europe, now doing a great job, was at Spurs, wasn't promoted. Paul Barber, now probably one of the best, if not the best, chief executive in the league, was also at Spurs under Daniel Levy. These are all administrators who had the talent, had the brains, who probably should have been around Daniel Levy making the decisions at the football club. But ultimately, Daniel was never good enough at spotting those people. You know, he was brilliant with the numbers, but he never had that instinct, that goodness, of that judgment of character, which I think would have been so valuable to the administration of the Spurs. And the other thing I think with Levy was just that sense of timing. You know, he had that ability, I think, to understand when a football club needs to take the next step. You know, we know those kind of three or four moments in the kind of modern era of Spurs when they were on the cusp of something. You know, the Champions League final, of course, but there were other two or three times. You know, when they were there. You know, the Leicester City season. When maybe a more ambitious chairman would have said, this is our moment. This is where we have to go and spend two or three really good signings that will push us over the line. I don't think he ever had that sense of timing, you know, of understanding the rhythm of a club and when something needed to be done and when it didn't need to be done. And I think those two things, more than the visibility and the communications, more than him being an awkward personality and being a slightly kind of shy character, all of that stuff, in my opinion, is there, but it's fluff. And actually, the main thing that Daniel didn't quite get right at Spurs was that sense of getting the right people around him and knowing when to act and when there's opportunity to be seized, you know. And I think that's where ultimately he didn't quite get into that final step.
I think just to add to that, it is interesting that Peter Cherington, who's come in as the chairman, he is a chairman in a non-executive capacity, which I think sounds quite sort of managerial speak. But what I understand that to be is just a bit more similar to what most chairmen are like, or chairs in the Premier League these days, to your point about a modern structure, as opposed to the power that Levy had. I mean, Levy always seemed to push back on this suggestion that it was basically him running it all the time. Like, even when Ange got sacked, if you remember the statement, it was, you know, this was a board decision, a collective decision. My understanding is generally a lot of it was down to him. Ultimately, he had the final say either way. And I do think this sort of new model, if it is to work as Tom's suggesting, and the suggestions by Peter Charrington's just his tight job title would suggest that is the case. That is something to be quite welcome. But also, you know, I've spoken to people who would have no real reason to go into bat for Daniel Levy over the years. And they all do say, you know, whatever you say about him, he cared about Tottenham pretty much more than anyone at the club, at least. So that would sort of concur with what Tom was pointing out earlier. But I think you're right. Yeah, I think decisions made over the years just prove to be often wrong. But what's fascinating about this whole dynamic is it's not a new ownership that's come in. It's effectively the same one that's been there the whole time, albeit with new decision makers. So when we talk about, for example, with salaries and this whole wage to turnover 42% figure, which one might argue great business to be able to compete at that level and pay that sort of relatively little. Others might say, well, when you look at how the Premier League or top football works, yes, there are examples that go against this, but in general, you know, the more you pay in wages can normally relate to more success. You know, how much of that was him versus how much of that was the ownership together with him, and how much of that really will change? That is what we wait to find out.
I mean, that's you've come to the nub of the matter, but here comes communication again. I guess maybe he has one hand tied behind his back. But I'd love to have heard over the past two or threes why it's so important to have this lower wage structure. The fact is, you rightly say, 42% figure in February, this very cautious financial footing over a number of years, which, as I've mentioned earlier, has of course put Spurs in a very safe position. We as fans, sorry, I'm appointing myself self-made leader of the gang here. We don't want safety. Let's take a gamble. To dare is to do. He didn't dare enough. We've got to take this risk now with Viv. Viv's my friend now. Charles and Nick. Well, she will be my friend if she sanctions some major signings. So, are they going to? Well, they have to, having made this change, Tom, because they're going to look pretty stupid if they get rid of Daniel Levy and have even less wins thereafter. So are they now in a position where they've got to spend big? But equally, is this ultimately just a little holding period before they actually sell the club?
Yeah, it's a big question. And those close to the Lewis family are insisting, they're adamant that Levy stepping down is not dressing the club up for a sale. I think the bottom line is there that it kind of remains the same as it has been in the last few months and years, where there is a valuation. If the right bid came in, then I think any club is for sale. And I think that has been and is still the stance. You know, if someone stumps up 4 billion, then I would imagine Spurs would be very much for sale. It's a difficult one because you hear a lot of people saying, even right now, in the last 24 hours, that the sale is on and that the club is going in that direction. Equally, it's hard to distinguish those kind of comments and suggestions from the ones that have been made fairly regularly, to be honest, over the last kind of 18 months or 2 years, where there have been constant rumblings about bids coming in from various parties. Two or three of them probably slightly more regular than others, but those rumblings have definitely been there. There's a slight complication there, and obviously Daniel Levy has been and still is just a minority shareholder. So the idea that someone could buy out Levy's stake, for example, I think has been mooted. But ultimately, that doesn't give you control of the club. That just gives you a stake in a company which controls the club. You know, so that there isn't. It's. I don't think it's quite as simple as what we might think. There has been indications, suggestions that Levy was the one who was resistant to a sale, and that therefore are the Lewis family removing Levy to then facilitate that and make it easier to do. Those questions, I guess, are going to kind of remain. I'm not going to pretend to know the answers to them right now. In terms of the spending, it feels to me like the January transfer window is a long way away. We know we're September the 5th, and I think there's still a lot to be kind of worked out. I think probably the more kind of relevant point right now is if you kind of go back to where all this began at the start of the year when Spurs were, I don't know, where were they in January? It must have been sort of 14th, 15th with about four players available. The club obviously carried out this review, you know, or hired an independent company to carry out this review. And it wasn't a sort of financial review. It was sort of said to me that this was not a Man United trimming the tea ladies kind of review. It was a very much a football review, you know, looking into why the club was failing. And you can imagine, you know, where Spurs were in January, and everyone remembers that, why you would, you know, want to carry out a review of what was going on. And I think at that moment, basically, we were all carrying out reviews at that point. And they were reviewing everything in the football departments, right? And I think it was at that moment when they decided that ultimately things had to change, you know, and that was when we sort of started to see the board changes made. Obviously, Charrington becoming a non-exec director in March. Then we had the Donna Cullen, obviously, leaving, Munn leaving in the summer. We had Vinay coming in. I think that was announced in April. He started work in June. And there were various kind of pieces of the jigsaw coming together. And I think we all had it in mind that Levy would be part of that. And obviously, when Vinay sat down with Levy and did that kind of joint interview where they were talking about their love of red wine, we all kind of thought, oh, well, maybe this is going to be a sort of a cozy partnership. But actually, I think within the very kind of close circle of Lewis Trust, Levy's removal was in the pipeline all the way along. You know, all the way from the beginning, they had the idea that Daniel would not be a part of the new structure. I don't think the timing of that was quite decided. And it's interesting why they decided to do that now, perhaps because they wanted the transfer window to sort of still be kind of carried out fairly smoothly. But all the way along, they had in mind that Daniel would be taken out. And I guess the bottom line...
Taken out. That sounds a bit sort of a... It was bloodless. I'll reiterate, it was a bloodless coup.
But the bottom line from all of that is it was a sporting decision. It was a sporting review. You know, all the way from the beginning, it was about the football and about the team and about how to generate more success on the pitch. So, you know, all these things at the moment, as I said at the beginning of the pod, are just words. And until we sort of see the actions, I think we can all be sceptical. But I think the motivation anyway for these decisions has been to make the team more competitive, more successful.
Yeah, well, let's hope that that proves to be the case. Tell missing out for the Champions League squad. There was quite a lot of headlines about that. I mean, to be honest with you, someone had to miss out, didn't they? And it's a complex business. Should we be questioning Thomas Frank's decision making in that regard, Tom A?
No, but I think we can question to what extent he believes in Matthijs Tel. You know, given the fact that Tel was signed. He was confirmed 3 days after Frank was confirmed. So I think, given that Frank was spending the first couple of days of his Tottenham tenure, you know, hosting a huge family party back in Denmark, I think we can probably say that Matthijs Tel wasn't necessarily sort of a huge Thomas Frank signing. And also the fact that he played for Spurs obviously long before Frank was appointed. So I don't know if we call him a club signing yet, but I think it's fair to say that he's probably not one that Frank necessarily, you know, vouched for right from the start. And he's hardly played so far. It's a small sample size, but he came on for the last 14 minutes against Bournemouth, hasn't started a game yet, I don't think. So I don't think we question Frank's judgment, but I think we question the kind of joined up thinking at this point as to whether or not, you know, the sort of spend of 30 million on him in the summer was the right thing to do. It's early days, you know. I think Tel is still someone who could perhaps flourish under Frank, but he's obviously not. You know, he's obviously low down the pecking order. That's especially what it confirms, isn't it? That he's below basically all the other wingers, and there are quite a few of them in that Tottenham squad. So,
going back to the Levy situation and the way that business was conducted, but I mean, he was a classic signing, wasn't he? Really, that the sort of young, promising, not too expensive. You could throw Odegaard into the mix there. I mean, Brennan Johnson to a degree played a lot more than we thought he would last season, and he's such a difficult player to analyze, because just when you think I never want to see him on the pitch again, he'll pop up with another goal. So there's certainly something about him. But maybe these are the sort of players, Tom, that hopefully we won't be signing in the future if this new policy is going to be implemented of, you know, wanting to win more often. Then you've got to raise the bar when it comes to, you know, bringing in important players in key creative positions.
Well, I was actually just thinking about Levy with Matthijs Tel, but not just Tel, pretty much all of the business they've done this window. And I'll come on to explain in a minute why. But, you know, a lot of when you speak to people about dealing with Levy. In fact, you don't even have to speak to people off the record. I mean, Sir Alex Ferguson's famous quote about dealing with him in negotiations. There are many like that. And I do think there have been times where clubs have found dealing with Tottenham with Levy difficult, maybe arguably to the detriment of Spurs. He would obviously argue it differently. And when you look at some of the deals they've done this summer, it does feel quite, even though I actually think it's been a good window, each deal has been kind of almost sort of typical Spurs, quite opportunistic. Like Kudus comes in, I think he's been brilliant so far, obviously not so great against Bournemouth, but generally. But West Ham needed to sell. Then you've got Paulini, it's a loan deal. Then you've got Xavi Simons. By all accounts, Leipzig wanted to sell. And then you've got, obviously, Mwani at the end, where they've kind of done a lot of the legwork last January trying to bring him in. They've got a pretty good relationship with PSG. Just that seems to be often the case. And when you talk about younger players, I think it does come back to the wage bill, what we're talking about earlier about 42%. How do you sign players on less money generally? Generally younger players. So I think there's a reason, there's a sort of joined up thinking why there are so many young players that come in. Not to say that's a bad strategy, just what often it's been for Tottenham in recent years. And so, yes, like you, kind of back to the whole point that I made earlier, is we're all waiting to see if this new era is going to be very different or more of the same, given it's effectively the same ownership.
I mean, I think it's a really good point Tom makes there about the sort of recruitment strategy of Levy, because I always thought that it kind of was quite it's quite short term thinking. You know, the way he did deals was always about getting the most out of that individual deal and representing the club in the best way possible in that moment. And I think he always thought, and this is what I think about Levy generally, is I think he always thought he was doing the best thing for the club. Like, I don't think he ever thought that he was, you know, not acting in the best interests of Tottenham. He thought that.
Well, I'm going to just stop you. Okay, let me stop for the one thing. How on earth was removing Jose Mourinho 6 days before a cup final doing the right thing for the club? That to me was inexcusable. As poor as Mourinho was over his 17-month tenure, you do not get rid of a manager who is capable of producing something special in a one-off cup final. What was going on there?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, in hindsight, it looks like it was the wrong decision, and it probably was. We don't know it. And Mourinho, Tottenham may well have lost also to Manchester City in that final, by the way. We can't assume they would have won on the basis of the way they were playing. And I guess the thinking at that time was you bring in a new manager, an interim manager in Ryan Mason, and you hope that the uplift in the dressing room gives you a one-off performance. In my opinion, it's not a particularly logical way of thinking, but I suspect that was the way that Levy was thinking. I don't think Levy sacked Mourinho because he thought it would give Tottenham a worse chance of winning the final. You know, I think that's the point I'm making. I think he thought that would make them have a better chance of winning the final. And I think that was the same in every deal he did in the transfer window. You know, he thought that by trying to get the extra 3 or 4 million off the Eze deal that they missed out on, that would then make Spurs more able to make other deals. You know, this was his thinking. I'm not saying it's correct, but this is what he was thinking. And I think the general strategy with the market, Tom's right, is it created a sense of reputation about Spurs, which I think ultimately really shot themselves in the foot. And what you see now more and more is that clubs who sell well and who sell smoothly and who sell quickly actually are able to recruit players much more easily as well. Because you look at players like clubs like Brighton or, you know, even Chelsea, for example, when players know that they can go to that club, be very good for 2 or 3 years, then get a move very quickly on somewhere else, they know, okay, that's a good club I want to go to because ultimately I can keep going. The problem Spurs have is that players don't really want to go there because they know they could get stuck. Clubs don't want to negotiate them with them because they know they can get stuck. You know, then there's always this sense that I don't really want to get involved with Tottenham because ultimately the whole thing is too difficult. So that kind of short-term thinking that Levy had, I think worked for 10, 15 years when Tottenham was sort of a mid-table team trying to get up into the kind of top six. But once they became a big player, I think Spurs sort of outgrew that kind of strategy. And in the end, I think it did more harm than good.
Which comes back to your overall point, I think, Tom, which I actually agree with now you've explained it so eloquently, that his main failing was his decision-making. Effectively, it wasn't so much all this other stuff, which you've described as fluff. Maybe I give it a bit more sort of significance and importance than that. But ultimately, it was that. It was the choices he made along the way, many of them proved to be the wrong ones. But I agree, having spoken to lots of people, I don't doubt he felt like he was doing it for the right reasons. And what's fascinating about your point about players feeling like they might get stuck, I mean, first of all, your point about, you know, clubs letting players go, selling them at the right time. You know, I'm thinking of Newcastle this summer, like with Isak. If he wanted to go, they should have let him go a long time ago. It's already cost them at the start of the season, and they could have got someone in far quicker. But that's obviously for a Newcastle podcast. But there's a similarity with Tottenham when it comes to selling players. You know, they should have sold Eric Dier at a certain stage, and they didn't. But what's fascinating now is Christian Romero. I find Christian Romero's situation fascinating because here is a player who was agitating for a move so much last year. It felt like it really did. Like, you know, I know fans might sort of, now he's signed a deal and he's the captain, sort of putting their head in the sand and just deny that was the case. But it's really rare that a player does what he did last year without sort of pursuing a move. And with 2 years left in his contract, you think, if he really doesn't want to be here, why would he sign one? And now but he did. Admittedly, Levy was still there at the time. Is that, in a way, regardless of all the other business we've seen this summer, the biggest perhaps indicator of a potential sea change at the club? I look at that contract renewal and think, that feels significant. I might be wrong, but feels quite significant.
Hang on. Are you suggesting that Romero knew that Levy was going to go?
I'm not saying that. I'm saying this sort of strategy change at Tottenham in the summer seems like that was an indicator of how things were starting to change. Not specifically about Levy leaving, but just how maybe those days of players being worried about being stuck at the club, maybe a sort of slightly paying more in wages. I don't know what he's on, so I'm not sure what that is, but it just felt like such an about turn that it felt maybe emblematic of a whole about turn regarding the club.
In terms of Daniel Levy's legacy, and he said not so long ago, I won't be appreciated until I'm gone. Well, he's gone, and we have gone over some of the issues. Tom, you say the lack of communication is fluff. I say that that's been fundamental to the growing discord between club and fan base over the past few years, which has reached epidemic proportions, or had prior to the news yesterday. In terms of decision making, you get through 16 managers in 24 years. Mate, you are making a heck of a lot of bad decisions. You take your transfer deals up to the line season after season. We knew he was going, but it wasn't until the last day that Dimitar Berbatov walked out the door, by which time it was too late to get in a replacement. That kept on happening. Michael Carrick, by the way, didn't want to leave Spurs, according to an excellent piece by Henry Winter, which I read yesterday. He begged Levy, negotiate a bit harder. I want to stay. No, Levy got his extra £3 or 4 million. Michael Carrick, who was a huge player to the club at that stage, went off to Old Trafford. I think deep down he felt, yeah, I'm doing what I think is right for Tottenham Hotspur. But actually what he was doing what he felt was right for Tottenham Hotspur as a business, not as a football club. Clive Allen, many, many years ago, said that Daniel Levy is not a football man. Sure, he may be a Spurs supporter, but making an extra few million quid on a transfer, I feel, was always more important to him than 3 points on a Saturday afternoon. And for all those reasons, sure, and I said it at the start of the podcast, when I go to the ground every weekend, I'll say, yeah, okay, thank you, Daniel. This is a magnificent stadium. By the way, it still needs much better infrastructure and transport. Build a new tube station. David Lammy, who got on board saying what a great job he'd done yesterday, sort out the infrastructure. You know, in the 21st century, making people walk 40 minutes to queue up for 25 minutes to get on an old train is not acceptable. So try and deal with that, because you love the community fact, and Spurs are a key part of the community. But the bottom line is, thank you, Daniel, but goodbye. And now let's gamble and let's see what happens. And let's be excited and electrified and dare to dream. Enough from me. Tom B, final word.
I mean, I'm just wondering how many times your headphones are going to fall out of your ears, Marcus, on this podcast. I do love the passion. We always love the passion. I think we've pretty much covered it all, really. I mean, you mentioned about Levy's comment to Gary Neville. I think that's right. But we have to, you know, we need the passage of time. Same as Ange, really. Like, he despite writing a book about it already, that victory in Bilbao, we need, ironically, we need sort of 5-10 years to pass to see what comes next, to work out how special and how sort of one-off that was, or if it was the precursor to success coming on later on. I realize I've just completely talked down my book there, but with Levy, you know, all the work that he's done, all the positives that we have pointed out, will they lay the foundation for a really successful era in the future? Got to wait to find out what happens next before we can make that judgment.
I mean, I listened to Marcus's criticisms there, and it strikes me that on quite a few of those points, Levy kind of lurched from one side to the other. You know, you think about how in the first half of his tenure, one of the big criticisms of him was he continually sold Tottenham's best players, you know, too early. You know, we think about Modric, Carrick, Bale, you know, Berbatov. It was always kind of, why are Spurs selling their best players to Man United and the big clubs? And then you think sort of later on, in the last kind of 5 or 6 years, the criticism of him was that they didn't move that team on quick enough. You know, that the Pochettino team, that they could have, I mean, you mentioned it, they could have sold Dier, Dele Alli, of course, you know, they kept that team together for way too long and they didn't actually recycle it quickly enough. And then if you think about the managers as well, like, I think early on in the first half of his tenure was, I was going to say reign, but it's not reign, is it? His tenure, you know, it was all about build off, wasn't it? It was all about sort of Martin Jol and those kind of, and then in the latter half, we're now kind of criticizing him because, you know, he tried to appoint the kind of the winners, the Jose Mourinho and the Antonio Conte. And I wonder if part of the thing with Levy and the way, the reason he kind of lost his way in the last 6 or 7 years particularly is because he sort of lost sight of what he sort of understood Tottenham to be. And maybe that was because Tottenham sort of outgrew him, that in a way that all the things that made it work in that first sort of 10, 15 years no longer really applied when he was trying to get from the next step from fourth to first. You know, it worked from 10th to fourth, but actually those things didn't really work when he was trying to do the second thing.
So is he the equivalent of one of those managers who is an expert at, whether it be promotion from the Championship or getting into the Europa League, but just making that next step, taking the club as far as he can? You know, that classic phrase about managers. Is that what you're saying about Daniel Levy?
Yeah, he's sort of the Unai Emery of chairman, isn't he? You know, he'll get you to sort of fourth or whatever, but he can't quite handle the big clubs.
Unai Emery.
Sorry. So that's an interesting impression, Mark. It's good. Yeah, it's good. It's better than your Postecoglou, I think.
I always think
the Conte decision for Levy is always, I think, you know, massively draped in hindsight. You know, at the time, everyone thought Conte was an absolute masterstroke for Spurs. He was thought about one of the best head coaches in the world, one of those kind of instant winners who would always bring success to teams. And it was seen as a real sort of coup for Tottenham to get him. And now everyone looks back and says, well, of course, you know, why on earth did they hire Conte? He was never a Tottenham kind of coach, was never the right person. And I think Levy's made loads of wrong decisions, loads of missteps. And Marcus, you have, you know, recounted many of them. And I completely agree with all of that. But I maintain that he sort of made the decisions with the right motivation, even if it wasn't with the right judgment. I think his judgment was poor a lot of the time in those moments. But I don't think he wasn't trying to do the right thing. And maybe I sort of know what your answer will be, Marcus. But do you think the club should mark Levy leaving in any way? Do you think it would feel a bit strange to sort of have a chairman of 25 years, nearly a quarter of a century, go out the door without anyone even kind of saying anything about it? Do you think in any way that the next game or anything, there should be any kind of gesture to kind of mark his departure? Or do you think that the fans wouldn't treat that with much pleasure?
I think we'll have a massive party. That's what we should have. I did read one person on X suggesting that after 25 minutes or 24 minutes, wouldn't it, for the number of years, that there should be a minute's applause for Daniel Levy. I suggested, well, yeah, okay, so after 2 minutes, we'll have some hysterical laughter for the two trophies we managed to win. And after 16 minutes, we'll all laugh uproariously for the 16 managers that came and went. There is respect for him, of course. He did some good things, but I don't think the majority of the fans would feel they need to say anything more at this stage. Tom. I'm sure in a few years he'll come back and he'll get a nice round of applause when he takes his seat, when we're champions of Europe for the third year running, when we're paying our players properly and buying A-star performers rather than B-minus performers, and not lurching from one style of manager to another, and not denying our seniors their ticket concessions and trying to get rid of people during furlough and all the rest of it. No, I'm not in the mood for anything sentimental or romantic like that. He had 24 years. He earned a lot of money. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Before we go, we should say to people that if you're listening to us on podcast, then we are now on YouTube. So please also give us a go at watching us. You can see Marcus's earpods falling out live.
10 times. These are new. I'm taking them back.
There's that steam literally coming out of your ears, Marcus.
I got a bit excited. Sorry, guys. Got a bit overexcited today.
And if you are on YouTube, then please give us a like and a subscribe as well. That really helps us. We're also all over social media these days, on Instagram and also on X, as we have been for a long time. And if you want to get in touch with us, any comments, any suggestions, any questions, then please do email the Tottenham Way pod at gmail.com. We've had some really good emails recently about really interesting one about Brendan Johnson playing up front, an interesting one about the selling policy of the club not being good enough in recent years, which I think is a really interesting topic. Someone said it was a 20 out of 10 transfer window, Marcus. I don't know if you agree with that. So we've got lots of questions, which maybe we'll try and get to in the podcast next week, because it's an international break, assuming nothing else super major breaks like it has in the last couple of days. But yeah, thanks for all those comments and questions, and keep them coming in. And yeah, do try us on YouTube if you can.
Yes, and also in that pod next week, assuming this time, we'll go into a bit more detail about this blockbuster new book, Miracle in Bilbao, written in a remarkably short period of time, but written remarkably well. Well, I say remarkably well, as I say, he doesn't write remarkably well. Written with his customary brilliance by Tom Barkley, with a lot of inside knowledge of what was going on during that quite extraordinary second half to the season in particular. So we will revert to that. But Tom B, thank you very much indeed. Tom A, thank you very much. Apologies for these headphones. Yes, if you are watching on YouTube, I don't know what's wrong with them. And also, there's a dog. There's a dog that is doing our head in here in southern Poland that barks all night. So I hope he is a lassie. It's very sweet, but it just keeps on barking. Barking mad, a bit like me. I'm Marcus Buckland. Come on, you Spurs.